Sunday, divine worship at 0800. Get your bunks made and get your uniforms on. Police call will commence in 2 minutes. Private Cowboy, Private Joker.
Sir, yes, sir. Sir, yes, sir.
As soon as you finish your bunks, I want you two turds to clean the head.
Sir, yes, sir.
I want that head so sanitary and squared away that the Virgin Mary herself would be proud to go in there and take a dump.
Sir, yes, yes, sir.
Private Joker, do you believe in the Virgin Mary?
Sir, no, sir.
Well, Private Joker, I don't believe I heard you correctly.
Sir, the private said no, sir, sir!
Why, you little maggot! You make me want to vomit! You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm gonna stomp your guts out! Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Sir, negative, sir!
Private Joker, are you trying to offend me?
Sir, negative, sir! Sir, the private believes that any answer he gives will be wrong, and the senior drill instructor will beat him harder if he reverses himself, sir!
Who's your squad leader, scumbag?
Sir, the private squad leader is Private Snowball, sir!
Private Snowball!
Sir! Private Snowball, report your daughter, sir!
Private Snowball, you're fired! Private Joker is promoted to squad leader!
Sir, aye, aye, sir!
Get the fair, scumbag!
Sir, aye, aye, sir!
Private Pyle!
Sir, Private Pyle, reporting your daughter, sir!
Private Pyle, from now on, Private Joker is your new squad leader, and you will bunk with him! He'll teach you everything! He'll teach you how to pee!
Sir, yes, sir!
Private Joker is silly and he's ignorant, but he's got guts, and guts is enough. Now, you ladies, carry on.
You're listening to the Hammer Radio Network, and we'll be right back with our top stories right after this.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. We play fair and we
work hard and we're in harmony.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse.
My thoughts drift back to erect nipple wet dreams about Mary Jane Rottencrotch and the great homecoming fuck fantasy. I am so happy that I am alive in one piece and short. I'm in a world of shit. Yes, but I am alive. And I am not afraid.
Boy, that was wrong intro. Good morning, everybody. And this intro was a long intro because I was in a meeting, and I'm back. Welcome to the show, everybody. That's not my regular intro, but you're listening to Hammer Radio Network, the number one morning show on Blog Talk. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. We are worldwide. If you'd like to come in the studio, we have a very special guest today. And excuse me if I mispronounce this gentleman's name wrong, but it's Michael Stephen. I'm thinking Daigle, D-A-I-G-L-E. I know I mispronounced it, but he'll correct me. But come on in the studio because it's going to be a great interview. Michael, as it says, this book is the fourth in the award-winning Frank Nagler mystery series. It's a prequel. Frank must find a serial killer who has started what the me calls an experiment in death. Frank is also dealing with the illness of his wife as the murder case comes close to home. This is going to be one exciting interview. Join us. And if you're a murder mystery kind of person, and I think you are, you know the number. Come in the studio. I'm going to do an interview. The interview will last about 15 minutes. You can ask. It'll be a question and answer period. And if you'd like to come in the studio, 319-527-6099. 319-527-6099. All right. Without further ado, we're going to get into the interview and my guests. Okay. So it's Monday, everybody. It'll take us a little while to get back into sync. Here we go. Without further ado, I'm going to open up the studio. I'll open up the doors and let Michael come on in. I'm going to give him a nice little welcome here. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I think Michael's here. Now, the problem is that there's two numbers that are private numbers, so I don't know which one's Michael, so let me see if I can get... I'll go to the numbers. Here we go. Is this Michael here? Michael? Hello? You're live on the air, 111. That may not be Michael. Michael, is this you?
Yes, hi.
Oh, there you are. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you. Not
good.
A problem. It's Monday morning.
It is Monday morning. Let me put the other one on hold here because I don't know what that number is going on here.
Okay.
There we go. We got you. Michael,
okay.
Welcome to the show. Let's get right to it. Why did you write the book, Michael?
This is part of a series that I started publishing in 2014. After I'd written the first three, I was starting on the next one and realized there were some questions that needed to be answered in terms of my main character's background. Frank Nagler is a detective in a small city in New Jersey, and mm-hmm. the other stories delineate his background, and there were some questions. So we went backwards instead of going forwards.
Okay. And why did you choose, well, I'm not going to go into why you choose murder mysteries. It's only obvious. I love detective movies and detective shows and great book. And Michael, tell me about your characters in your book.
Frank Nagler is middle-aged, as you alluded to, in this book, The Red Hand, which is the prequel. This is his first
mm-hmm.
big case. At the same time, he's dealing with this experiment in death. His wife is quite sick, and he's juggling how to take care of her and how to find the killer, and the case gets very personal when the signature of the killer, the Red Hand, shows
mm-hmm.
up on a shed across from his house. In the other books, this situation haunts him. He feels that he didn't do enough to ease his wife's suffering, and he also sees his hometown of Ironton, New Jersey, falling into economic disrepair, and he wonders how he could fix all of that. So he takes on a lot of the anxiety of the town.
Okay, now this is book four.
Book four.
So if it sounds interesting and good character, so if, would I have to start for book one, two, four just to catch up, and or is this is not a one offer? It is four books. So the first book that people should buy is, because I have The Red Hand here, but so what's the first book that people should buy to catch up on a character?
The first book is called The Swamps of Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rewrite of a story I wrote, you know, many years ago, and after I actually learned how to write and had spent 30 years as a newspaper reporter, the story came together. It's the first in the series, and it dumps Frank into the middle of a messy murder, political, economic mess, which is a theme that runs through all of the books. The second book is called A Game Called Dead. It's about an online terrorist, and it's structured as a game. There are rules. There are good guys and bad guys, and the rules change. And the third book is called The Weight of Living. It's trying to find out who this young girl who was left on a street in a bad, cold March night is that leads to an entire investigation into old crimes, old family secrets, and all of that. They are, while it's a series, you can pick up any one at any time because each have separate stories. There are themes that run through them, and many of the characters like Frank and Jimmy Dawson, a reporter, and a few others, carry on from story to story, but each one has a separate storyline in each book. The Red Hand was the prequel to go back and sort of put Frank in place.
Great.
And I've had people read them out of order, so it was designed that way.
Well, let's get a sample. you did great. Right here we have an audio sample of The Swamps of Jersey. This is the first book. And give them a little feel, and we'll talk about the red. I think it's the red hand we're going to talk about today.
Yes.
Great. Let's give them a little sample. It's going to be good. Here we go.
Okay.
The ringing phone grabbed Detective Frank Nagler from the fitful sleep he had found, crammed into an office chair like a discarded suit jacket. It was 3 a.m. The phone rang again, buzzing like a swarm of flies. He rolled dizzily sideways, slammed his feet to the floor, and sat in the chair, feeling his back clench. Crap. That hurt. The phone rang again and again. He rubbed his eyes with the palms of his hands and waited for one more ring, then picked up the receiver. You're kidding, he replied wearily to the dispatcher's request. What's next? Locusts? Yeah, never mind. Thanks. Just what we need after all this. Be there soon. He wrapped himself in his long black raincoat that had become his shield against the wet and raging world, and leaned into the outer door as the hurricane wind slapped him awake. He had not seen the sky for days, felt the heat of the sun, wore dry shoes, or walked outside without that raincoat since the storm blew in and sealed the hills above the city with a dense smothering grayness, a swirling menace of thunderclouds and shrieking winds that pounded the city with an apocalyptic rain that sent the Baptist preachers howling to the hills about sin and damnation. It emptied the grocery store shelves of everything but a few cans of cream of mushroom soup and locked the residents in the top floors of their homes. As the river crashed its banks, flooded streets, and rearranged the city landscape like a madman with an earth mover, the placid blue August sky had been replaced by rain that came and stayed. Rain with menace. Rain that pulsed around corners dark with dislodged pieces of the earth as it ripped away every weak thing it could. Rain that claimed. Rain soulless and dark as evil. That challenged knowledge. Rain that took possession. The ancients knew what to do with rain like this, he thought, wickedly, squinting into the horizontal blast of water. Conjure an honest man with the ship and spin a parable about the wages of sin. Nagler laughed sourly, and then get out of town. Nagler plowed his car through the treacherous bumper-deep water that filled the downtown streets. Random spotlights, swinging loosely from dangling wires on damaged poles or hanging off ripped rooftops, banged with the hollow, doomed echo of cathedral bells at the end of times, and flashed a shifting and sinister light on flooded parking lots or intersections rippling with dark water. Store after store was dark, some with boards covering glass windows. Others had jagged shards of glass that gleamed menacingly in the fractured light, hanging in dented window frames. Half an hour later, Nagler edged his old Ford down Mount Pleasant, squinting through the wet, smeary windshield into the flashing safety lights as he looked for a place to park. He found one that was too narrow but jammed the car in edgewise anyway, braking hard when, at the fringe of his headlights, he saw a jagged black space where the embankment had washed away. Oh, damn. Great. All I need now is to drive off the road. He shouldered the car door open, and the scene exploded into sound. Yakking radios, a dozen vehicles left running, grinding fire trucks, winches, distant shouting voices. But the sound that mattered most to Nagler was that of his right shoe being sucked into the liquid soil. Oh, shit. Damn it, dress shoes. What was I thinking? This is the fine quality of decisions we make when we don't sleep. Ironton was sprawled at the bottom of a narrow bowl-like valley, with streets climbing the hills like fingers hanging on for dear life. For the better part of a week, as the last waves of an August tropical storm stalled over the state, the bowl filled and overflowed. Nagler, like the rest of the police department, had been on extra duty to deal with the storm emergency. The weariness of sleepless nights, more than the dampness, dripped through his skin to his bones and joints, and he walked with a heaviness that made him think that if he stopped moving, he would end up standing in one place for hours, unable to lift a foot or bend a knee. He tugged his foot from its watery hole, almost losing his shoe, and winced at the discomfort of wet socks and wet shoes and general unpleasantness of what he was about to examine.
Very good. Good narration there. Good narration. You know, when I enjoyed it, I was just thinking, a lot of millennials going, what is a receiver? So
yeah.
I was just laughing. I was just thinking.
Well, actually, that's part of Nagler's shtick, is that he's sort of a technological dinosaur in a game called Dead, where the other guy is, you know, supposedly this internet genius. The killer in that story actually scolds the police at one point because he doesn't think they're catching up with him electronically, when in fact that's not true, but he doesn't know that. But Frank is sort of a dinosaur, and he has to bring in people to, you know, turn on his computer and things like that. So it's part of his charm. You know.
That is cute. We're going to go back to The Red Hand now. That's your latest book. So when did it come out? It's on sale now on Amazon, I assume.
Yeah, it's on sale. It came out last year about this time. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available in an e-book form. So if you have a Kindle, you can download it for free. In paperback, it's also available in an audio book that we just released about a month ago. We found because that voice was because Frank, excuse me, was much younger in this book, we found a reader with a little bit lighter voice, and his version of The Red Hand is really thrilling. It's well done, and we're really pleased to hear it. But The Red Hand is the introduction to Frank, but as I said, you can pick up the story anywhere in the series. It sets in place a lot of the background story that runs through the whole series, the condition in Ironton, Frank and his battle between his personal life and his police life, and just the set. In The Red Hand, too, because we have an unknown killer over many months leaving bodies all over the city, there is a sense of not just concern, but paranoia and terror. Riots break out. There's street demonstrations, and the old mayor, who's, you know, an old-time politician, takes advantage of this and gives lots of speeches about how, you know, they're going to catch the killer, and aren't the police doing a good job? And then 2 days later, he holds another rally and yells at the cops for not doing a good job. So he's this erratic, crowd-rousing politician. And all of that is part of the whole background that I think makes the story compelling.
Well, it is compelling right now. Michael, can you pronounce, can you pronounce your last name for me? Because I know I probably screwed it up.
No, you had it right. It's Daigle, D-A-I-G-L-E.
Oh, okay. There you go. Hey.
Yeah.
Okay. Michael Daigle. Michael Stephen Daigle. You know, when I pick up a book like this, what audience are you trying to reach? Are you trying to reach the 16 and up, maybe the 9-year-old who's interested in murder mysteries and so on and so forth? So who are we targeting?
I think, honestly, when I published the first book, I was trying to reach anybody who could read English, essentially. These are books written for adults. I was at a book show one time, and a 9-year-old kid said he was interested in the books, and I cautioned his parents. I said, you know, you can buy them for him, but you should read them first, because my characters use bad words. They engage in activity that maybe 9-year-olds, you know, aren't ready to read about. But they're written for adults. There's a lot of swearing. But, you know, adults swear. And when you get in pressure situations, you act in an adult fashion. If you like murder mysteries, if you like thrillers, this is the market that you should hit. You've got a compelling character. Frank is an everyman who carries the weight of the world on his shoulders. And in that sequence that you read from the that we played from the Swamps of Jersey, the tone there was what I was looking for this whole series. There's a sense of overarching doom on this city.
Right.
Frank becomes, in the eyes of other people, he becomes the last honest man in town. And in the weight of living, there's a scene after there's a horrible event that affects many of his friends. He is at a place that I've created called the Old Iron Bog, and he's been going there as a kid to think. And his companion steps out of the rain and says to him, "Frank, I know you want to be here, but I can go home and grieve in private. I can go cry in my pillow, but you have to grieve in public. It's not fair, but that's who you are, and that's who we need you to be." And so that's what he's carrying with him through the whole series.
That is interesting. But writing a book, when you write about a serial killer, and I'm trying to think of a mindset to do it, because you have to be clever with the, you know, depending on who the serial killer is, and you got to imagine clues, and then you go into a separate psychological thing with you, saying, okay, the serial killer did this, but then you're leaving clues here. How hard or creative was that? Because it's almost like writing two books, isn't it? Because if you're going with the point of view of the serial killer, now you're also writing a book within a book, aren't you?
Yeah. To a degree, because one of the things I didn't want to do with my serial killer, Charlie Adams, is make him an attractive nuisance. We see on television all the time when they go back and look at the like Ted Bundy, the guy who killed women all over the country. His modus operandi was charm, and unfortunately he gets in the reporting sometimes it's left out that this charm was simply a gambit. It was part of his evil, not because he was a charming guy. And Charlie, I wanted to focus on the victims. I mean, he does horrific things, but focusing on the victims was a way of showing his depravity and his evil by talking about the victims as regular human beings. And at the end, it's a big setup, because when he finally shows up in person, he's a snarling, nasty old little guy. And that's what I want you to see when he shows up, that he's not some cuddly, misunderstood, you know, man. He's the embodiment of thoughtlessness and soullessness and harm. And he says, you know, in the interviews at the end, he says, "I don't care who these people were. I never cared who they were. They just happened to be there," you know. And so you want to be able to play that level of disinterest in humanity off Frank's humanity. I mean, if anything, is Frank is almost too human at times when you compare him to Charlie Adams. And also the city is responding because they're afraid. You know, there are scenes where grandfathers complain to the cops about, you know, "You need to catch this guy because I have daughters and granddaughters," and that whole bit. But I wanted to be able to compare the world that Charlie lives in by walking around the edges until he shows up. So,
you know, I love your creativity and I love the storyline. You know what's really risky, though? I was just thinking when you were talking, when you get an audio, and if the guy sucks, you're stuck with that audio. I mean, are you stuck with that narrative, that narration guy? Because that's going to be the voice of the book. Or you have that? You take that risk about that?
Yeah, it's something that we think about, all of, which is why the guy who read The Red Hand is not the guy who read The Swamps of Jersey. And it's going to be interesting because we think we're probably going to use Dane Peterson, who read The Red Hand, for the other two books in the series, because our goal is eventually to get them all in an audio format.
Right.
But when I've compared the two, and to a certain degree, Lee Allen, who read The Swamps of Jersey, had most of it right for an older Frank Nagler in his 40s, a little rougher and all of that. Dane was perfect for The Red Hand because Frank is 22 or 23, and you need to have a certain lightness in the voice. But the thing in the notes that I gave to him is that at the end of the book, Frank can no longer sound like a teenager. He seems to sound like an adult who has learned some of these hard lessons. And the thing that made his reading so good was that you could you could listen to Frank's voice age as the story moved forward. And it's tricky. We auditioned, we auditioned like 70 people.
Wow.
And if you ever want to realize how many mistakes you make as a writer, listen to the same page and a half read back to you 65 times. It just all jumps right out at you. And you go, oh, man. it's a whole learning process. And I'm part of a small 2-person independent publisher from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I've been amazed how hard they work to promote their authors. They've done a tremendous amount of work for me online, and we're adding new people all the time. They're really trying to grow their company. We have a terrific Anita, who does the covers, terrific graphic artist. But the support that you get from the company, and it's a deal. I have to do a lot of marketing myself, but they provide a lot of the materials that I can use. They've done trailers for all of the books. They do spot ads periodically. All of this stuff is available. They send it over to me and say, "Here, we just did this. Why don't you use it?" Tremendous support from two people.
And what's the name of the publishing company?
Imzadi Publishing, IMZADI. And they're from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we just signed another woman from New Jersey who did a memoir about her husband who was a pilot, and Anita did the cover for that. And I heard from a gentleman from Eastern Pennsylvania. I live in Phillipsburg, New Jersey, which is just across the river in Western Jersey, across the Delaware River from Easton. He had reached out to them and he contacted me. He had a couple of questions about things. So I answered his questions, never heard back from him. I'm not quite sure where his book is, but I landed in the right place. I've got a company that's interested in, my success selling books and independently helping grow their company. So,
well, congratulations. And the graphic and the book cover looks amazing. We're almost out of time, but I do want to hear a little bit of The Red Hand. That's what you're here for. Here you go.
Thank you.
Nagler hunts along the dark street and parking lot, following the blood trail back to the Chinese restaurant on Warren, apparently the original crime scene. A crime tech photographed the blood drops, exploding light into the darkness. "Lot of blood," the tech said. "Man." Why carry her to the train yard? At the restaurant, a shapeless pool of blood filled the sidewalk a few feet from the door to the China Song restaurant, and a smeared trail of blood leaked off toward Blackwell and the train station for a few yards and then stopped at a point the assailant must have picked her up. A blotch of blood was centered on the side window of the corner phone booth, as if the assailant had staggered for a moment under Chen's weight. Pretty strong for a little guy, if our drunk friend was right, Nagler thought. But the victim was a small woman, so I guess anything is possible. It reminded Nagler of one of those nature specials where a lion kills a zebra and carries it off to be devoured later. A hunt, a kill, a trophy. Of course, that's what Mulligan meant. The restaurant lights were still on, and Nagler saw the face of a man peeking around a red pillar inside the second inner door. A grocery bag of packaged food had been spilled on the sidewalk, and a purse leaned against the curb. A bloody spot dotted the brick wall. A second medical officer took samples. Related? Nagler asked.
Seems so, from what the dishwasher told us,
Patrol Sergeant Bob Hanrahan said. He had run from the City Hall police station a half block away and secured the scene.
She apparently stepped out of the restaurant carrying that shopping bag. The attacker rammed her into the wall. She was probably stunned by the blow to her head, staggered, and then was stabbed.
Hanrahan nodded to Nagler.
It's your scene now.
Nagler examined the oversized purse and found a locked blue canvas overnight deposit bag containing what felt like 2 or 3 inches of bills.
Probably not a robbery.
He found a wallet with a driver's license. Joan Chen, 31, Western Street, Ironton. Nagler felt his head spin, exploding with details almost faster than he could examine them.
You all right, Frank? Hanrahan asked. Like I just took the plastic wrapper off my Crime 101 manual and the killer is on to Volume 2.
He screwed up his face and glanced at Hanrahan and then at the ground.
I want to do this right.
Hanrahan grabbed Nagler's shoulder.
Slow it all down. We know some stuff. It'll come.
Nagler nodded. Hanrahan said as he shrugged toward the restaurant door,
That guy's the dishwasher and he stays after closing to clean the place for the next day. She's the manager and was going to the bank to make a deposit. He was locking the doors when someone came out of the street, slammed her into the wall, and stabbed her. He said he ran back into the main part of the restaurant to grab the pistol they keep behind the bar, and when he came back, she was gone, as was the assailant. He said the attacker had his head covered, wore dark clothes, but the attack was fast.
Did he say anything about the attacker's size? Nagler asked. A witness at the train station, as drunk as he is, said it could be a small person. Hanrahan shook his head.
He said it happened really fast.
Any other witnesses? Nagler asked.
Customers? No. Place closed at 9:30, 2 hours ago. Dishwasher said Chen's habit was to eat a light supper, close out the daily receipts, and hit the bank on her way home.
Weston's on the other side of town. She must have a car park somewhere, Nagler said as he scanned the street.
Bet she left at about the same time each night. Someone who knows that pattern.
He sighed. This could be the first one of these that makes sense.
She married?
Look at you. Look at that applause there. I think you got a hit on your hand. I love the voice. Love the story. Great choice.
Thank you.
Really
yeah,
great
thought,
choice.
Thank you. I thought he did a really nice job with it. The thing that struck me, and actually I had somebody else who was... I was doing an interview with later on in the book. There's a guy named Manny Calabrese. He's an old Italian jeweler, and he appears in a couple of the books. And he's the place that everybody in town gets their family wedding rings and things like that. He does a lot of handmade jewelry, and the reading of Manny prompted this other guy. He said, you know, I was listening to him, and he sounded like my uncle. You know, one of these old, gruff Italian guys who talks like this and, you know, is a friend of everybody. He calls Frank Frankie. He called the mayor, you know, Howie. You know, it's just this big, you know, it's the kind of thing that old-style do, because that's how they sell their product, and he's a big bear of a guy, and you know, and I thought afterwards, I said, you know, that's what you'd hope to hear in the reading, that the work you put into creating different character voices shows up, and it did there, and I thought that was an interesting comment, that of all the people in the book, that was the guy who got him to read more of the story.
Well, you did great. Well done. And, well, we're at the end of our interview. It goes really fast. We're talking with Michael Stephen Nagel. And the book is called The Red Hand. and you just heard it, and it's on sale now at Amazon. But get the whole, get 1, 2, 3, and 4. I mean, you just can't go in and buy number 3 and then go back to 1.
Yeah.
Don't be a moron. Get all 4 books. What I'm going to do, Michael, I'm going to give you 30 seconds, and just in case we didn't go over any talking points or and if you want to promote your company, it's all yours, buddy.
Yeah, thank you. As Brian said, I am Michael Stephen Daigle. I'm an author from New Jersey. I've written a 4-book series, mystery series, called The Frank Nagler Mysteries. They're available on Amazon, and actually we have a COVID-19 stay-at-home sale. So if you have an e-book, you can get it for a buck. These are strong stories, great characterizations, and my character, and this is a humble brag, was called by Kirkus Reviews as one of modern fiction's expertly drawn detectives. I read that, got up off the floor after I read it and said, holy smokes. That kind of response is what any author dreams about but doesn't get very often. So I'm very happy that people read these books and see the work that I put into them and hopefully like the characters and the settings. They're fun. They're fast. There's a lot of background with characterization and sociology and government and all of that, but they're also page turners, because if you don't get the readers to turn the page, then you're writing a textbook, and these are not textbooks. These are murder mysteries with good characters in an evocative setting, and I think that you will enjoy them if you take a gander. I appreciate it very much. I'm thrilled to talk to Brian on his radio show. What a terrific interview. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, sir. You made the interview. You were a terrific guest. You did the hard work. You did the heavy lifting. All I did was ask some questions. You did was great. I want to ask, too. I just want to not ask, but I want to make an announcement. This is a 5-star mm-hmm. book. He's an award-winning author. This is not a novice person. This is a true author here. So you're going to get some good quality work, good quality reading, and you heard the narration. I mean, I'm hooked. Michael, thank you so much, and I want to thank Mr. Frank Nagler for visiting. And I hope you have a good day, and anytime you'd like to come back, sir. Please do. I enjoyed the interview.
I really enjoyed this, and I greatly appreciate you inviting me to your show. And continued good luck.
Thank you, sir.
You take care now. Thank you.
You too. There you go. I'm sitting off with a crowd here. Look at this.
Alrighty.
Your fans. Yeah, they love you.
I love it. Great show.
Great job. We'll be right back. Thank you, sir. We'll be right back with more. Joe's in the studio, and let's get the book. The book is called The Red Hand by Michael Stephen Daigle. It's on Amazon now. Get it. It's a good read. We're back. Maybe we have like 8 people in the studio. So maybe somebody had their speaker on and that was it. Let's get Joe in the studio right now, because I'm not going to take another break and hear that. Joe, how you doing, buddy? Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Joe? I don't know if Joe can hear me, but Joe's in the studio. And I don't know if anybody can hear me right now. This is where the awkward thing is. And Joe, can you hear me? 605. Maybe it's not Joe. 605, you're live in the air. All right, then I'm going to have to test the studio out myself, since I don't have anybody else to go after. Let me test this, see if we're still working here. Because that was really... Here we go. Let me test the studio. Nope, we're still here. All right. Joe, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes because I'm talking to you. And maybe your app can't hear me. You may be able to hear me live. I guess not. All right, guys, what we're going to do is we have a – I'm thinking I'm still live, but I'm going to cut the interview – I'm going to cut the show short because nobody can
hear
me. Now I could. Now I could. How you doing, buddy?
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah.
Are you sleepy already? I'm going to have to call you Sleepy Joe. Are you sleepy?
That's right.
All right, we got. You know how we end the show? We got to end the show. We have two shows. We have a double hitter today, so that was a great interview. Don't forget Michael, Stephen.
What's the other one about?
It's called The Red Hand. Get the book. It's on Amazon now. And the other interview we're coming up is where is she? Lovely lady. I didn't get a chance to talk to her, but she's coming up. She's going to kill me. I'm going to cheat here. Wow, that's interesting. Okay, hold on. Great, Joe, you would have to ask me a hard question, wouldn't you? All right.
Yeah. Who's your guest? Wait a minute.
You would. Agnes is coming on. Verona.
Yeah.
Ooh, I think it's Cuban, and I can't pronounce it. Aquendo. She's coming on, and she's going to be talking about. Now, this is interesting. Serial killers are in style. She's a self-publisher. She has 4 books. She has a book, Running Against Cancer in 2018, My Shorts and Dark Whispers of a Serial Killer in 2019, The Nurse's Diaries in 2020. They're all available now on Amazon. Nurse's Diaries. They're all available now on Amazon, and she's coming right up. Presently, she's a nurse right now, presently working on Nurse Diaries 2. I'm sorry. She's working on Nurse Diaries 2 and a children's book. So there you go. So, especially with the pandemic thing going on, this could be interesting. So, she's coming up in about 17 minutes. Meanwhile, I'm talking to you, Joe. Joe, okay, you know how we end the show. We got to do things. You know, it's very interesting that I found.
No, it's okay. If you want. I'll put myself on mute, and then.
No. Our interview is over.
So
this
is.
We have a little time to kill. Okay. So if Mr. Dagan wants the edited version, he won't hear any of this. All right, you ready? We're gonna play this game, Joe, and then we'll leave. Okay, you ready? Cole was just in here.
Okay.
Here it is. This is going to be interesting because you know how we think of 20 years old, 19, 20, 25 as kids? You know how we think as kids? Well, this is an interesting thing. 25 things you're too old for now that you're 25. So we're thinking they're kids, but they're saying – now that you're 25, these are things you're too old for. Here we go. I thought it was interesting. So I never thought of 25 saying, okay, you're 25 and you're too old for this stuff. So this is, you hear what I'm saying. So it means you're closer to death turning 25. Boy, that makes you feel good, huh?
That's what it says.
So it means you're closer to death turning 25. It's actually great. You get to jettison tons of pointless crap from your life forever. Here it is. It says, I don't know how old you are. I don't care. It's the thing, because once you hit 25, you're absolutely stopped caring about the ages, names, and personal details of people around you. Now, I didn't know that, Joe. Joe's asleep. All right. I'm going to just go through this anyway. So I found it interesting looking at this at 25, not 30, not 40, not 50, but at 25. It goes, at 25, occasionally having sex or buying things, I hit that milestone. Even though I still have a childlike face and a body that would allow me to order off the kids' menu forever, I started to feel a change inside. Something said on a fleek to me, and I didn't even bother to find out what it meant. I went to McDonald's, and at the end of the night, and thought, actually, no. And then went home and instead had a single carrot. I started a savings account. Young me, rebellious me, with no responsibility outside of a job transcribing phone calls, young me is absolutely gutted at that development. Old me, now old her is 25, by the way, I just have to say. Old me, that is to say the new me, could not give less of a shit. Again, we're in mind of a 25. Sometimes when twilight is descending, I find a bench by the sea and watch young people and peacocks go up and down the promenade. It's then that I think back fondly to the things that 20-year-old me used to do, sorting Skittles by color, then dropping them into 6 bottles of vodka, and later dropping a perfect rainbow of vomit into and around the toilet at my mom's house. Skittles and vodka. Really enjoying Christopher Nolan's Batman movies and telling people how much I enjoyed them. Reading a book and thinking it was important. And then I think, what an awful, awful garbage person I was. No one wants to hear my thoughts on Slaughterhouse-Five, and they never did in the first place. Fuck. So in deep analysis, remember, she's 25. A deep analysis from our CEO guy tells me vice readers are either 25 or approaching 25, and as such are in dire need of guidance. Consider me your wise old sage, because I've been there. Hitting 25 is a first true reminder that life is finite. I'm going to mispronounce words, Joe, until you come in. And you are dying by the second. Fun. At 25, this is what she's saying. You are dying by the second. And because of this, it's a good age to open your eyes, clear your head, and stop doing things that you are too fucking old for anyone. Here they are. These are things that you're too old for at 25. Doing drugs to impress people. Anytime I ever done cocaine, I just want to call my parents. Once while smoking weed, I watched as one of my friends very slowly pissed herself. Is that what drugs are supposed to do? Either way, it's not for me anymore. Not anymore. If your thing is getting fingered in a cab by a dude with coke on his hands, then please, by all means, go and do that right now. I'll even hail one for you. But when you hit 25, I think you know whether you're actually like doing drugs. With all this waiting around for a drug dealer and futile toilet visits and all the times you're expected to rip your shirt open to the navel like the famous soccer lady and shout, I love doing drugs. Or whether you're just doing them because the cool kids are doing them. We are shown boring videos about peer pressure in high school, and for fuck's sake, they end up being right. There's no point doing drugs after 25 unless you're in it to win it. So unless you're a full-blown addict, it might do you good to stop now. It might be a good idea if you're a full-blown addict. 25. Being ID'd. It's number two. It's really fun being ID'd when you're young and actually have an ID, because there is something glorious about the face people pull when they are counting backwards and trying to figure out your age from your birth. But then when your ID twice is the same night, but when your ID twice the same night by the same fucking bartender and you are 25 years old, it becomes more tedious. Also, I'm way too good at ordering from a bar to actually be the age I look, which is 14. Also, if I were 14 and trying to get drunk, I wouldn't be asking you about the Fernet or ordering a $20 old fashioned, especially not by myself. Number three, eating bread with wild abandon. The days of me eating an entire baguette with some brie. Where are you, Joe? Is it brie or bry? Brie, I think it is. And then fitting into my jeans the next day over. Number four, this is when you're 25 and you're too old to do things. Trying to understand young people with their young people music. I will give you $100 to the first person who can sit me down and convincingly explain how Nick Jonas is considered talented and likable, or how a decipher of anything Ariana Grande is saying ever. Number five, drinking for loco or, come on, Joe. Okay, Joe. All right, I'm not reading this anymore. All right, I'm not reading this. Number six, panicking at an ATM, because Joe's not playing with me. When you are poor, the cash machine is kind of like the Wizard of Oz, as in you treat it like there's a tiny person inside who decides to either gift you with money or make you look like a fucking idiot. The worst one is when you put your details in and ask him for $10, and the little dude swirls and clicks, and your stomach rises and your heart beats in your throat, and then he goes, sorry, this machine can only dispense $20 bills. And then you have to walk away in shame because you only have 15 bucks to your account. When you get to be 25, you are so over this guessing game that it's not even funny. Fuck ATMs and fuck banks. Fuck the tiny cash machines, trolls who loves to deny you the ability to go to see a movie or eat a decent meal. But also, critically, fuck having to pay for a pack of ramen noodles with a mug full of dimes. Basically, by the time you're 25, you should just take a few minutes to figure out how to manage your dough. All right, here you go. Seven, experimenting with a haircut. If you got to 25 and you haven't got every fringe or dye job or shape patch hair mistake out of your system yet, then you've been doing your hair wrong for a quarter of a century. Stop trying to stay current. Anything that requires more than two products or curling implements is a needless complication at your age. When you go to the hairdresser, ask for a short back and sides for boys, or a bit off the ends, but not too much off the ends for girls. That's it. That's your haircut forever. Enjoy it. Number eight, talking to anyone under the age of 22. I know that thing about the youngest people you can viably have sex with being half your age plus seven. But I don't know what I would say to a 19.5-year-old girl beyond like, hey, has anyone ever tried to explain floppy disk to you? Most of my conversations are basically just loudly references shit that happened when I was around your age, which means the girl in question would have particularly have been, and consider this as my resignation from talking to anyone born after 1994. Okay. Well, that's it. Well, wait a minute. One more. Number nine, engage in small talk. Sometimes I get introduced to people and I say, oh, nice to meet you. And they say, we met before. That's when you decide to never speak to that person again, if you can help it. Think about it. If they were that good at small talk, you would have remembered them. You only drink sidewalk slammers once a year these days, after all. So that shit isn't on you. At this point, the unmemorable person will start yammering on about some boring-ass fuck PR job, slowly back away while suggesting that they become interesting in the future. 10, taking convoluted subway rides. I never actually watched Sex and the City, but I'm pretty sure that lady took cabs like that all the time. And how? Her job was to literally write once a week about people whose dicks have been inside her. I have a real job, sort of, and I write several articles per day. Suck on that, Bradshaw. But anyway, if Hop Stop is telling me I have to travel to basically Midwood in order to catch a train that'll ultimately take me less than a mile west of my starting point, I'm just getting in a car. If fictionally sex lady can't afford it, so can I. Here we go. Shopping at the mall. I thought we're done. I'll do the shopping at the mall last one. Oh, and terrible friends. I gotta see what time it is. Oops. Okay, I got 5 minutes. So I'll talk really fast. Don't forget, our next show is coming right up, and you're gonna love her. And author Agnes Verona Aquindo, she'll be here. And first, I would have to hang up here and start the show over because it's a new show. But I'll try to get to these two really quickly. I'll read it really quick. 25 things. When you're 25, you had enough of this. You're too old for this. Here we go. Okay, blah, 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 shopping at the mall. I don't think my body is physically strong enough in my increasing old age to permeate the cologne bearing surrounding a store like Hollister anyway. Everything in Forever 21 is basically made of tissue paper meant to their blouses are like the ghost in the Field of Dreams, unable to physically exist after crossing a certain physical boundary, which in this case means the entrance of the mall. Stop buying shitty clothes. Here we go. Having terrible friends. If we go for a drink and I have to basically interview you to make a conversation, I'm not having fun. When you invite me to a Facebook event that doesn't even occur for 6 more weeks, I think you're an idiot. If you say we should hang out but don't suggest a time or place for us to hang out, you're not even trying. We also probably hate each other. I have difficulty enough managing the 3 friends I already have, and I don't have time to add any more. That's when you're too old for this shit. Bad one night stands, and I promise. Pretending to care about people's jobs and PR is the absolute definition of hell. Pretending to care long enough to seduce them, accompanying them on a 15-minute cab ride, navigate their tiny, dark apartment, knock a lamp over, and awkwardly fuck them, that's a real bad task. By the way, for all the effort, there's a 99.9% chance it's going to be terrible. If you find someone who doesn't work in PR and you don't hate fucking, hang on for dear life and never let go, but don't get married or anything. Ew. That's what she said. Spring break. If you're 25 or over, this idea seems appealing. I can't help you. And that's it. It goes on and on and on, but we don't have that much time. Hangovers. When you get to be 25 and realize the solution is literally just drink a glass of water and maybe eat a banana, you feel really, really dumb. Kissing bartenders' asses. I'm sick of it. And not having the heat on. Festivals. And we go on and on and on. So there you go. When you're 25, you're old. All right, guys. We will see you in an hour. Joe, are you still here, my friend? Wait a minute, Cole. Let me see. 2 minutes. Cole, is that you? 917? 917? Hi.
Hi.
This is Agnes?
Agnes. Yes.
Oh, you're early. Hi, Agnes.
I am. Anybody who knows me, I'm always early.
Really? Look at that voice. You guys got to tune in for the show. Look at Agnes. Wow. You got a nice voice, Agnes.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So what I have to do is I have to hang up on this show, and then people have to call back in for your show. And Agnes, it's going to be a really good show with you. Did you hear the interview with Mr. Daigle?
Cool.
Michael Stephen Daigle?
Oh, no, I didn't.
He's a great guy. He's got a great book. It's called The Red Hand. You'll love it. It's about a serial killer, too. I mean, you have that in common. It's about a serial killer.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I definitely have to look for that.
You sure do. All right, kiddo, I got to hang up now so we can start your show. We got 30 seconds, so we'll be right back with the famous Agnes. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you guys in an hour. Don't forget to call back in. Ciao. Call back in, Agnes. I can't wait to listen to your book. Bye.
All right. Bye.